Hello and welcome to Utecast, episode 42. This is Head of School Dan Glass with you once again, recording live here in the Sound Lab at the Brandeis School of San Francisco. And I'm super excited because we have a very special guest with us today, Isaac Jacobs Gomes, Mr. Jacobs, as he's known around these halls, who is a middle school English teacher extraordinaire, a Brandeis graduate, a wonderful colleague, and somebody I'm very excited to have with us here on the Utecast. So he has brought a poem, since, as you all know, we like to start the Utecast off with a poem. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Isaac.
All right. Hi, everybody. I wasn't sure if that was going to be Tribe Called Quest or Lou Reed. I'm glad I went Tribe. Awesome. Okay, so this is a poem by Barry Spax. Barry Spax was my teacher and mentor at UC Santa Barbara. It's called Within Another Life. Those whose days were grudging or confused may come back trapped within another life as a boulder or a pane of glass or a door that suffers every time it's slammed. If I return a boulder, love, some summer day, come sit by me and contemplate these horses and these hills. And if a window pane, gaze through to see the meadow on our walks where the brown geese strut. And if I am a door, come home through me, be sure I'll keep you safe. And if a knotted, twisted rope from long self-clenching and complexity, oh love, unbind, unbraid me then, until I flow again like windswept hair.
Wow.
Barry Spax.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful poem. And I love that, like, the sort of clenching and unclenching that's imagined in the relationship between the speaker and the person being spoken to in that poem. It feels we've been talking here at Brandeis this week about some of the events that have been going on in the world, and it's been a tough week for the world, I think it's fair to say. And one of the things that I go to poetry for and appreciate in that piece is that kind of catharsis, that space for unclenching parts of ourselves. So thank you for bringing that to open.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And actually, so we have a few things that we've talking about here today. And that takes me to one question that I have been thinking about. It is the role of being a practitioner and how that comes into play for your work as a teacher. And so you are a writer, you are somebody who has studied not just literature but the craft of writing, and you have your own writing practice, and I'm curious about how that, you know, both in terms of your training and the folks that you've studied with, as well as just sort of the work you do now, how you see it coming into play in the classroom and your work with kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing that I love about this poem as well, I'm kind of thinking about the poem in terms of teaching and writing. Unexpectedly, when I started reading it, I felt my heart kind of leap into my throat. I had to take a couple of deep breaths, and I love that this poem could be read at a wedding or, you know, during a sort of somewhat somber week and can elicit, I think I might have the same reaction, maybe for different reasons. There's something really incredible about how universal something so specific can be, which, I mean, as I guess a little bit of an aside, is one of the features of country music that I find most alluring and compelling. So it's interesting how, I don't know, I think this poem helps see some kind of hidden symbiosis between a lot of things going on. And teaching and writing feels the same way. I think that I kind of think of it the opposite, in the opposite direction, that teaching actually helps prepare me to write. The thing I love about teaching is the sort of almost like kind of flow state that you get in where there's a lot of control and structure, but then if when a lesson is going well, you're following, you know, where your students are headed. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of affect and approach is, I think, what makes sitting down to write enjoyable. Sitting down to write is also, sometimes I feel like I would always rather watch TV. but, you know, give it 10 minutes and you can kind of get into that space.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I love that. And I appreciate, too, just the reversal of thinking. I've always thought that, you know, when possible, it's great to hire people that think of themselves as practitioners, as teachers, because, I think it's important that the subjects that we're teaching in school are not sort of abstract academic subjects, that they should be, you know, lived engagements with the world, whether science and math or writing or art or anything else. And in some places in schools, it's easier to do that than others. Certainly, like, art is a place where generally people who go into the field of arts education have some, you know, engagement with the practical side of it as well. But I've always thought that was also true of scientists, right? You just want people that bring that sense of, like, exploration of a subject matter and excitement for it. But that's really interesting to think about it in terms of how your work in the classroom and the kinds of modes of thinking that you can engage in as a teacher also, you know, go the other direction and help prepare you to write. And I hear you on the sitting down to write piece. Although I think as a poet, I've always been able to, sort of chalk it up to the muses and, like, well, you know, if I'm, like, in the, like, a poem sort of descends upon me, and that's often how it feels. And then the work of revision and re-engagement becomes a sort of re-entry into that kind of whatever that is, that kind of flow state, that kind of dreamlike state almost. So, interesting. And actually, entry, this tangentially brings us to another thing that I have been thinking about a lot this week, and I want to tell a little bit of a story and then ask you a little bit about your work with kids.
Sure.
So today I brought my daughters, Sonia and Alma, to school, and Sonia is a third grader now, so she just, like, goes right upstairs and is very independent, but Alma's just in kindergarten, so I walk her all the way to the door. And I have been noticing, as we've moved from actually walking her into the classroom and dropping her off to, you know, walking her to the door, the practices of crossing the threshold that are present, the sort of classroom rituals that are very present for her. And so in the space of kindergarten, in Miss Larson's kindergarten class, there's the work of going and dropping your stuff in your cubby and kind of knowing that there is that kind of organization of space that helps engage in sort of coming into the classroom. And then there's also a sign-in, right? So, you know, as these little people are coming into writing and coming into language, you know, starting with their names as something that most of them are developing a capacity to write their names. So there's a little sheet, sort of a whiteboard, erasable sheet right at the front of the classroom that they know their first thing, kind of like a do now, mm-hmm. like you would have up on the board. The first thing they do is come and write their name. And it has me thinking about the different kinds of practices that we engage in as educators in creating that space to cross into the space of learning, and the thread here is about also the space of writing. So I'm curious for you, on either side of that, like, do you have, other than sitting down and wishing you were watching TV, do you have a way of getting into the space of writing? And also, like, what does it look like in your classroom? How do you sort of invite kids into the space?
Yeah, in sixth grade English, we're doing a unit that we're integrating with science. In science, they're learning about cells and neural cells in particular, about the structure and sort of cellular biology of the brain. And in English, we're reading about memory. We're reading The Giver, Lois Lowry's incredible novel, still as resonant today as it was in 97, I think, when it was published. And one thing that we're learning about memory in the essays that we're reading are about the different channels that memories are sort of created within. Schools are very semantic places. This was sort of the impetus for this unit that the science team and David Jeffries and I thought about. We tend to create memories and do our learning with words. We talk, we listen, we read, we write. But it turns out that there are other ways that memories are sort of solidified. And one of the most powerful ones is what, in an essay that we're reading by Marilee Spranger, she calls episodic memory, which are memories that are related to places. If you ever, what example we use in class is if you ever walk into the summer camp bunk where you've been year after year, you're all of a sudden flooded with memories of that place, whether you thought about it or not. And so it's helped me to think a lot about how classrooms function, that it is really a powerful sort of episodic memory hub. Whenever you walk into your classroom, all these sort of synapses go off, and all of a sudden you're in this space. You do cross a threshold to start learning. I challenged our sixth graders to go to their first grade classroom. When was the last time I thought about first grade, you know? But all of a sudden they are guaranteed to be flooded with memories from it. So I don't know. Now I'm actually pushing back against our initial assumption that, you know, maybe our default mode is to be semantic as teachers and learners, but I also think schools are places where place memory, emotional memories, associative memories are created all the time. Coming back into Brandeis after the summer, there's like a smell and a kind of a vibe and a sound and all those things, they just, you know, ignite all these memories, and it's kind of like the hum of the air conditioning in this room right now. We won't know it's on until it disappears for a second. I'm still trying to work out how to make that happen in my own writing practice. I also feel like, you know, I'll sit and sort of write frantically and get really excited about a piece that I'm working on. But I don't really have like a routine that I can really count on. Are you like a leaning on the couch with a notebook guy or a sitting up straight at a computer guy?
So I have not developed a routine practice in, this is now my third school year here at Brandeis. So I am very, very routine driven as a writer, and I get into sort of project modes that are, I actually love the episodic memory piece of this that you brought up, because it does, for me, it is often about not just time, you know, like time of day, but it's also about spaces. So like when I was living in LA, I rode my bike to work a lot, which was super dangerous where I lived, because there are only these huge boulevards with like no bike lanes. But a couple days a week, I would also take the bus because we were a one car family at the time. And I sort of wrote this whole project, a sort of serial poem, sitting with this one little notebook on the bus in LA. And it was like half an hour bus ride. And, you know, the space of the bus was obviously quite variable and permeable because it was different people on it. And the context shifted, but in a lot of ways it was also consistent because it was that container of the bus, and the amount of time I was on it and the notebook that I was writing in was all very consistent. And the projects that I work on as a poet tend to unfold in those kinds of ways where there's a consistency of time and space and a sense of what the project is exploring. And so one of my poetic heroes is Wallace Stevens, who I've shared in the Word of the Week a bunch. I've shared with our students here at Brandeis, and he had a big job that was, you know, took up a lot of his time, and eventually figured out a practice of coming in early in the mornings and sitting at his desk before other people were in the office and writing there. And there's something super romantic and compelling about that thought. And I've never even approximated being able to do something like that, but I would love to have that kind of practice.
That feels to me like a connection also between teaching and writing, that a friend of mine, Adam Spiegel, Brandeis alumni, he's a distiller in Sonoma County. Shameless plug, Sonoma County Spirits, check it out.
Shout out.
He works, just because he's in Sonoma County, he's surrounded by a lot of vintners and other people in that industry, and there's so much romanticism attached to it. It's beautiful. You're in like a Tuscan sort of landscape, or I guess Northern California landscape. It's also just a dirty, sort of workaday, difficult physical job. It's labor. Mm-hmm. You kind of peel away some of the layers of romantic, from it, and it's tough. Mm. And I think that in many ways, I've heard writers talk about this as well, that writing feels the same way, that it's a mechanical process. You're alone. There's a lot of, kind of intricate, difficult work to do. It's tiring. Mm. Wallace Stevens sold insurance. And I think that, being able to convey that to our students is important as well, that I think, we want our students to be inspired, and we work hard at that, and we celebrate when that happens. But there's also, so much power in just coming to your work every day, when it's hard, when it's tiring, and just kind of letting, finding some rhythm and some joy in that process. Here, I guess, in the Bay Area, we call it grit sometimes, but I think that helps too. That really helps my teaching, and reminds me to, I'm inspired by my students' grit often. So that's what, helps me turn off the television and hit the desk for an hour, a couple of days a week.
It is amazing that I often reflect on how much it would be wonderful to be back in school and to have the time and the space where, like, you're being told, like, no, you really need to sit down and just work on this piece of writing, or, explore this mathematical concept, or, experiment with this idea in a science class, or, to say nothing of all the kinds of engagement with the world that our students get to see that I didn't benefit from in terms of the kinds of hands-on learning that we're doing here at Brandeis. And unlike you, I didn't have the benefit of a Jewish day school education. So also just the kinds of engagement with the spiritual world and the ritual world, all of that is very rich. We have today, we're heading out. So another kind of crossing the threshold I have been thinking about is a big chunk of the community is heading out today to go up to Yosemite. And I've been going back and looking at some of the writings that John Muir did in discovering, with strong air quotes around that phrase discovering, but encountering as a European American Yosemite Valley for the first time. And there's a quote that I pulled out that I want to read that I think is really interesting, because it comes from a moment right after. So Yosemite was the third national park ever created after Yellowstone and Sequoia. So interesting, two of the first three national parks are California parks. Not long after it was created, it became a tourist destination, because there were already a lot of people in the 19th century living in California, and I think exploring the natural world was very much a part of popular culture at that time. Like, it was a thing that one did the kind of vacationing that people did. And so this comes from right after it was Yosemite was opened, and there was this question of, you know, how one should engage with the valley as a space. And so what he wrote was, "I would advise sitting from morning till night under some willow bush on the riverbank where there is a wide view. This will be doing the valley far more effectively than riding along trails in constant motion from point to point. The entire valley is made up of points of interest." I love the sort of defensiveness of the naturalist against the, like, you know, the tourist approach to, like, you know, the points of interest. But I also, what I appreciated about that in the context of what we're talking about here is, you know, how one creates those spaces, right? Like, in whether it's in the day, in a lesson, in your week, in your month, in your year, to really stop and engage differently with the world. And I think it's one of the great gifts of Judaism as a practice, is the notion of time as a sort of sacred, and that, like, it's really, as in the John Muir quote here, it's not about going and checking that box. It's not about sort of seeing all the particular sites. It's really about, like, how you think about a moment and sort of enter into a space that makes it engaging and interesting, that makes it special, right? Or sacred, if, you know, if you want to use that kind of language. So again, like, back to this question of, you know, crossing various thresholds and creating kinds of space. I'm curious, so we've talked a little bit about the daily practices and all of that. I wonder, like, for you as a writer and a teacher, and thinking about the rhythms of your work, are there ways that you try and sort of set aside time or engage with time differently to refresh, rejuvenate, you know, bring new ideas into your work?
Yeah, I think that inspiration is, it's like sleep, where the more you want it to happen, the further away it is, the more elusive it is. It's,
that's, I mean, a great
it's
analogy.
Like, such a difficult and interesting, and there's a lot of beautiful tension there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one thing that I love, I feel so proud of to be a part of at Brandeis, is the mindfulness practice that is happening in, you know, classes across the curriculum, I mean, across the school. Nicole Schoentag, which also she's my wife, she teaches first grade here, shared with me last week that her first graders are up to 4 minutes a day of meditation. They were doing body scans last week.
Wow.
What a joy to be, like, have that be sort of like my job. Like, my boss tells me to do this. That's amazing. And I think that is, for me, a really big part of the key of finding inspiration and actually being sort of open to crossing thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
I think that being aware and aware in a particularly kind way of yourself and of what's happening in your head is key. That's what, you know, I have been working with my sixth graders and advisory on as they're coming into middle school in a new place. You can't always control, you know, what the world is like, or what your classroom space is like, or your life at home is like. And you also can't always control your reactions to it. But it gets a little meta, but I think that you can control how you react to your reactions. And as so long as you're just kind to yourself whenever possible, you know, I think that helps wake you up to the opportunity to find inspiration or to let it come to you. Because the flip side of that is, you know, the sort of like, get inspired, stupid, come on. And that,
yeah,
like sleep, you know, that just won't happen.
Yeah.
So
I did have on my whiteboard in my office last year, I had meditate with an exclamation point written up on the board. And I would see it and, like, feel bad because I was not meditating, yeah. and I felt how counterproductive that was to be shouting at myself to make space for more mindfulness. But I love hearing that, and I'm really excited too. I mean, the other day I was home, and so Alma, my kindergartner, I forget what the context was. It was late afternoon. The sun was starting to set, so it must have been early evening. And for some reason, we were sitting in the kitchen, just the two of us, and we were kind of killing time. We were waiting for something. I forget what. Maybe we had a dinner out or something. And so I said, you know, so what do you think we should do? And she said, well, how about we do some mindfulness? And so she had me get crisscross applesauce and was teaching me lotus breathing with her hands. And, there's such power in, as you say, that kind of metacognitive, like being aware of how you're reacting to things. Brandeis parent Matt Wolfstadt once described it to me that, like, he used to, in trying to engage in a sort of meditative, mindful practice, would feel his mind wandering and then, like, get down on himself, right? Like, man, I'm doing this wrong. And then he met with a teacher who said, you know, you're thinking of that wrong. Like, that moment when your attention wanders, when you're not sort of just being present, when you're thinking about the grocery list or, you know, that email that you need to send, or, you know, the various to-do lists that make up our lives. And then the work is bringing yourself back to an attentive, present state. And he said that he was encouraged to think of that as, like, strengthening his practice, like the same way that, like, you know, doing reps with weights makes you stronger, right? Like, you are strengthening your capacity for being in a mindful present state. And so I love that thought. Shout out to Matt Wolfstadt. I'm still not very good with my own mindfulness practice, but it has been really exciting to see how it's been coming together and threading throughout the work we're doing at school.
Absolutely.
Also, just the depth of the connection between Jewish practice and this kind of mindful meditative work. Rabbi Alan Liu of Blessed Memory taught for years and years at Congregation Beth Shalom here in San Francisco about Jewish meditation, and we have a parent group that meets here on Wednesday mornings to do Jewish meditation with our own Tanya Lowenthal. So lots of good connections there. We've covered a lot of ground here today, Isaac.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's Adam's distillery called?
Sonoma County Distilling Company.
Okay.
Beautiful Rohnert Park, California.
So this episode of Yudcast brought to you by Sonoma County Distilling Company.
Yeah, you can find his products at, there's a bunch of Healthy Spirits locations throughout San Francisco. He's all over the place, but Healthy Spirits is a really good bet to find his stuff.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We got to try some at the gala last year, I have to say. It's quite excellent. It will lift your spirits, pun intended. Thank you all for being here with us. Big thank you to Isaac for joining us on the Yudcast. It's been wonderful to have this conversation with you. Shabbat Shalom to anybody who's listening on Shabbat. Hopefully you guys are up in Yosemite, some of you, and maybe you can listen to us up there. And we'll be back with you next week.